Hi, this is Sarah Falls bringing you the second interview for Art Tectonic for the ARLIS NA Annual Conference 2008 in Denver, Colorado. Today's interview is with Megan Prelinger of the Prelinger Library in San Francisco.
Hi, this is Megan Prelinger from the Prelinger Library in San Francisco. I'd like to introduce our collection to you. Our collection is books, printed ephemera, and government documents, and bound periodicals, and some unbound periodicals. It's wide-ranging, mostly focused in the nonfiction zones on developing a cultural and visual history of the 20th century through uncommon materials. We have the collection is organized around the core interests of my spouse, Rick, and myself. This is our personal book collection that has just gone a little bit crazy. We are both interested in North American regional landscape and land use history and social and political history. I have a special interest in natural history, and Rick has a special interest in media history. So those are the points around which our collection coheres. And we've really supplemented our personal, regular person book collection with a pretty wide array of vertical file materials, including, pamphlets, handouts, menus, all photographs, all kinds of materials that were unbound and not meant for long-term publication or long-term use that constitute kind of a special artifact collection. And our government documents as well, for much of the late 19th and throughout the 20th centuries, various branches of U.S. departments various investigations employed really talented artists and writers to create monographs on farming, agriculture, industry, development, housing. And our collection is extremely image-rich, and a lot of image-richness is in these documents and also in old periodicals, places where image research doesn't always... It's not always the first stop for image research. And then the collection is organized fairly iconoclastically. We did consider using Library of Congress or Dewey Decimal systems, but when we looked at our collection as a sort of special set of items, we felt that those arrangement schemes didn't necessarily serve it, and that we would like to arrange it in a way that expressed the autonomous integrity of the collection in and of itself. So, for example, it's largely a landscape-based collection, so we decided to establish a taxonomy that would be based on the idea of landscape, the idea of kind of walking through a landscape of ideas. So it starts where our feet meet the ground in San Francisco and where the collection is housed, and moves through from west to east our North American regional landscape and land use history collections, and then wends its way through kind of the world as it's engaged on a pedestrian level, on a tactile level, on a visual level, to works that are then based on sciences of interpretation. So from, in other words, from regional history and then natural history and then industrial history and then cities and transportation and infrastructure, kind of around the corner into the middle into representations, architecture, graphic design, craft, advertising, and then into media. And we have what's called the media row that's a really deep cultural investigations into the realm of what's of interpreted information and broadcast network information. And then in the last row, we have the more abstract disciplines. So we're moving from concrete to abstract. We have from cultural history into political and social history, and then philosophy, math, and science, and space. And the collection kind of ends up in space, so the idea is that it started in San Francisco and ended in the galaxy, as it were. And that kind of mode of organization is, it wouldn't work for every collection, but it suits ours quite well, and it is iconoclastic, but it's not meant to be mysterious. People do express that they're able to dive in and find their way around just fine. People rarely get lost and need to be pulled out. And let's see, so we really do feel rewarded by having this personal arrangement scheme, and also on the scale at which we work, no subject is really larger than an arm's reach, so people can engage one subject, and even though the collection's not organized in a way that's immediately familiar to others, people can really engage it because it's all right there to be seen, you know, so it's not a sort of a hidden mystery. We do, within the arrangement scheme, create juxtapositions of materials in our collection that are not commonly juxtaposed elsewhere. Part of our project is really to foreground history, so we have lots and lots of contemporary books and recent books, but we try to put those books on a shelf right next to historic documents, if possible, original documents, to which they refer or on which their science or their study is based. And that lets visitors see the kind of alpha and omega of history making as a process right on a shelf, which is, it's really exciting for people, and it gets people involved in the contents of the collection. And that's really what we're trying to do, is make a sort of window onto images and ideas and associations that you wouldn't really find exactly presented in such a way in any other location.
And this is sort of an add-on question, but why did you decide to make this accessible to the public?
Oh, my husband Rick and I had so many books that we could not manage them on a domestic level. We have like 40,000 books, so we had been for years keeping them in storage and not using them ourselves and hardly even knowing what we had, and we realized we had to either, we had to do something drastic. We had to we really had to open a library because there just weren't any other options that would let us keep our books. And this idea was very consistent for both of us. We both deeply love libraries, had many of our best, most exciting moments of our lives in discovering books, and have a strong impulse to share. We both have backgrounds in the what is sort of termed here in the Bay Area as the free culture movement. Mm-hmm. Rick is the founder of the Preminger Archives, the film archive, and had since 1999 been putting films online for free download, and had been finding that giving away access to the film collection built a community around collection and brought rewards, including a higher degree of visibility for the business aspect of the archive, really more rewards than could have been imagined. And I had history in free zine publication, and we had both had kind of negotiated our relationships to higher education, and felt like we wanted to explore making a model of access to resources that would be a counterpoint to the way conventional institutions and conventional libraries structure access to arcane historical materials. A lot of the materials in our library are not in public libraries' general reading collections because they're historical and they're unusual. They're more consistent with the kinds of collected materials that appear in historical society collections or academic research library collections, mm-hmm. and not a lot of artists, not a lot of young people, not a lot of members of the general public visit those places or even know that they need to be or would want to be very interested in those kinds of places. And we were interested in the idea of opening a library that would be a community workshop where people could come and do work and exchange ideas and experience a library as a working collection in ways that institutional libraries are not always able to do. And also, we were interested in foregrounding our materials and just offering them to people as a kind of a gateway to inspire others about what kinds of historical research or image research they might be interested in doing, you know, not necessarily at our library, but elsewhere, but that they would not have known about if they had not visited our library. So it's kind of an exercise in, like I say, making a counterpoint to more institutionalized research collections, and then ours is like a public access experimental research collection where we kind of let people in and just see what happens. And we were both really very interested in doing this. We refer to ourselves as an experimental research library because this is sort of an experiment in the sense that we did not know what would happen when we decided to just put our book collection out to the public and open it up and see if we could convene community around collection, convene a workshop around a collection, and open a collection to you know, to people who wouldn't ordinarily encounter these kinds of materials. And it's really been fantastically rewarding, but those are the ideas behind it. And really, we started thinking about it many years before we actually did it. We had so many books we didn't know what to do, like the old lady with the shoe. And it, but it took several years, really, before real estate prices and our developing vision aligned and made it possible. And that was in 2003. We leased our space and we opened to the public in the summer of 2004. Mm-hmm. We're going into 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, very much so. Sort of my next scripted question is sort of about the sorts of researchers that come to your library. And, you know, what do they come to look for? Are they looking specifically for images or text, or are they looking for a little bit of both?
So our collection has... We've really been slightly surprised and very gratified that we are used, our largest visitor group is artists doing image research.
Mm-hmm.
We knew that the collection was very image rich when we opened it up, but still it's books, and I expect books to attract readers and writers sooner and more immediately than it attracts artists. But that's actually not what happened. It turned out that we know a lot of people who teach, and most of the people we knew who are teaching are teaching in art and visual media. And they started bringing their classes and using the library to host class workshops and using the library as a resource space for assignments. And those classes and those workshops really began to take on a life of their own, where the students would then come back on their own and bring their friends and their families, and people are doing, we've had about 3,000 visitors in 3.5 years,
wow.
And I'd say that's two-thirds artists and filmmakers and media makers doing image research, and also doing text research for ideas to go into projects, but most of the projects, about two-thirds, I'd say, are visual media-based projects. And then the other third are general readers, writers, novelists come to us doing historical research, independent scholars writing histories, and the curious bibliophiles from all over the country and even all over the world. We've been lucky to have a bit of publicity, and sometimes people say, oh, I read about you, and I'm only in San Francisco for 48 hours. I'm here on a flight between India and Germany, and I have 48 hours layover, and I want to come spend the day at your library. And that happens. So there's this portion of the visitorship that's kind of the national and the worldwide bibliophile community just wanting to see what we're doing. And many of those people are as interested in the library as a concept and as a project as they are about actually engaging the books in the collection. And so that's been interesting as well. But people do, writers, historians, and novelists do come and use the library. It's the visual makers who are still in a larger proportion. And then the other part of our visitorship profile that maybe shouldn't have surprised us, but does, is that our average age of visitors is probably a very rough estimate, probably 24 years old, which is kind of wonderful and exciting. We kind of were concerned that our collection would be of interest more to aging historians of the 20th century and not of interest to people looking forward into the 21st, but that's not been the case at all. It's very, very exciting to young people. We find that younger people who have had maybe lower ambient levels of book saturation in their lives are more excited by the books as artifacts than people who grew up surrounded by a lot of books all the time. There's an element almost of the fetish of the object among people who are sort of born digital, who may not have really had the opportunity to hold an old book in their hands, maybe ever, some of them ever. And when they come to the library, they're just incredibly excited. And that we didn't anticipate, and it's just been wonderful.
Well, I know you mentioned in an email to me that you had an artist group come to visit, and I know that there have been other library groups that have come to visit. So, do you have any sort of relationships with traditional libraries or library organizations, or is it just are people coming by out of curiosity?
We have close relationships with lots of other libraries, including public libraries, and I think for librarians are very interested in what we're doing. In a way, it's it seems to me it's like transgressively satisfying for them to be in a book collection that breaks all the rules. And we are not librarians, so we don't obey the rules. Most librarians are just fascinated. Seem to be very fascinated with the project. Occasionally some of them doubt, that a patron could find what they're looking for, that we kind of, it's more about the experience and it's more about finding what you're not looking for. And, most people become librarians because they love books and not because they really want to live rule-bound lives. And so there's that aspect of it that brings a lot of librarians in just to so they can enjoy the experience. Really, it's librarians as bibliophiles who are coming in.
Mm-hmm.
But then also with libraries as institutions, we also have relationships because libraries are under so much pressure. For every new book that comes in, they have to get rid of an old book because they're under so much pressure with the use of space and the use of resources. And we we help them. We try to, if a historic book fits into our objectives and our set of ideas, we try to give it a good home. And so we have close relationships with a number of librarians who have a strong sense of our project and our collection and its sensibility, and to keep their eyes out for things as they're being deaccessioned and channel them to us, and then we can report that we've given something a good home and that it's found a new audience. So that's a very rewarding part of the relationship with libraries. And then we, of course, also refer people to institutional libraries who maybe start with us and learn something about an aspect of historical research that they're interested in, but that our that goes beyond really the scope of our collection, and then we can refer people to institutional libraries. So, and then institutional libraries also refer people to us.
Mm-hmm.
We have really nice working multilateral, multi-level relationship with public and institutional libraries.
So one thing I've been really interested in observing your collection from afar by, you know, reading the Harper's article that came out last May and some others that have been out on you guys is sort of your connection to the digital, which you just talked a little bit about, the fact that most of your demographic is NetGenners. I think that's incredibly interesting. And you also have an interesting connection to the Internet Archives. So, you know, how do you sort of define your role as an analog collection, but then still sort of touch out to the digital world? And sort of how do you see your place kind of in the digital world?
Back in 1999, Rich had been recruited by the Internet Archive to put films from the Film Archive online for free download. And that was really a very fruitful relationship that led to, like I said, much wider exposure for the Film Archive and really a whole new audience for the Film Archive. And it also led to Rick's advice being valued by the Internet Archive, and he joined the board over there and has had, you know, for the last 9 years, a close working relationship with the Internet Archive and its other board members. So that relationship was well in place, even while the library was, you know, just a twinkle in our eyes. And also, you know, Rick and I, you know, I've had backgrounds with electronic text distribution and as a way of breaking down barriers between academic and non-academic modes of discourse in the zine world.
Mm-hmm.
And with Rick's experience with the Internet Archive, for us, moving in the direction of hybrid analog-digital book collection was a natural, because neither of us really had the kind of experiences that would lead to a polarized sense of competition between print and digital realms. We both had experiences seeing where the analog world of materials and analog modes of access, as opposed to the digital world, digital collections and digital modes of access, we're really able to see how both of those serve different communities in different contexts at different times and did not negate one another.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Internet Archive was able, starting in about 2005, to sponsor us to digitize up to 10,000 of our books. We are the smallest library that they're working with, and we just give them some books to digitize when they're in between larger clients. So it's happening slowly, but we have about 3,000 digital books. And those digital books have been downloaded many, many tens of thousands of times. And it's very rewarding because many of the people who are downloading those, they're not local to the Bay Area. They're not able to come to the library. Or even if they were, they might still want to take the book home with them, as it were, and, you know, so we can give digital copies of books away when we can't allow analog copies to leave the library. And the analog and print collections complement each other. People can do research in the shelves, and if a book they're interested in has a book mark indicating it's been digitized, they know that they can, you know, have their own copy of that book, and that it's, you know, kind of fully retrievable in that way. So sometimes the analog collection is a doorway to the digital collection, and just as often, the digital collection is a doorway to the analog collection, where people come in and say, oh, I've been downloading your books for 2 years, but this is the first time I've been in San Francisco, so, you know, now I want to see the rest of the collection, and they'll spend the day browsing. And we really feel like that is going to be the future of the kind of resolution and the tension between analog and digital collections, where in the future they won't compete for audiences or compete with resources, but instead serve different communities in different contexts at different times. And yeah, we've really seen that. We haven't had any problems with it. You know, no one comes and says, well, the analog collection's not as interesting because I can get it all online, because you can't. Much less than 10% of it is online, you know, and it's just different. And also, the browsing experience online is not yet able to reproduce the experience of discovery, serendipity, and associative linking that's possible in a visit to the brick-and-mortar library. The two are just really apples and oranges, and yet they're converging at the same time to where I think the more digital books we have, the more thoroughly integrated that analog and digital experience will be, where it's just like two ways, two experiences of the same collection.
Well, I guess we've come to the end of our interview, so thank you very much.